This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hey everyone, I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist.
I'm Gemma Jones. I'm an improvement coach based in the UK and working with people around the world.
Well, folks, we are very fortunate today. We have a wonderful guest, Julie Dirksen. And Julie has written several books, actually, but we're going to be talking about a book of hers that came out in 2023 called Talk to the Elephant, Design Learning for Behavior Change. But before we jump right into that discussion, Julie, if you would, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and about your background.
Yeah, I primarily identify as an instructional designer, so I design training curriculum for different things. And, you know, now I consult with people kind of on learning strategy for organizations. And my degree is in instructional systems technology. I, you know, basically a big learning nerd from way back. I'm now into the third decade of this stuff, so I've been doing it for a while. And specifically, the behavior change kind of came about. I always attribute it to condoms, actually, which has led to a whole conversation with my publisher about whether I could put a picture of condoms on the first page of the book. We decided not to, but I still tell the story, which is in kind of the mid-2000s, I got attached to a project to create an online version of what was an in-person intervention at the time for AIDS and HIV prevention. And it was maybe like 2005, give or take. And by 2005, we were pretty clear on the message, right? You know, condom usage is the primary tool for preventing the spread of AIDS and HIV. And most people had heard the message. And yet we were still having, you know, infection rates higher than we would like, certainly. You know, and obviously the landscape of that has really changed with a lot of the advances that have happened now. But at the time, that was still primarily what we were talking about was condom usage. And so it was a real case of people knew what to do, but they still weren't doing it. And when I kind of went digging through my instructional design toolbox and really looking at the question of like, well, what do I have to help here? You know, we were working with experts in the field and, you know, we were getting guidance from them. But what do I have when it's not fundamentally a knowledge problem, when there's something else going on? And I didn't feel like I had kind of the right toolbox. You know, and so I went looking, and certainly we started to see some interesting answers around kind of the late 2000s with the advent of books like Thinking Fast and Slow and Nudge and the rise of behavioral economics. And that was interesting and helpful, but maybe not a complete picture there. I got attached to some health and wellness curriculum work. And, you know, again, that's full of people know what to do, but they're still not doing it around diet or exercise or sleep or, you know, medication adherence or any of those kinds of issues. And really the rise of kind of behavioral science as its own field was where I started to be like, all right, I'm starting to see sort of comprehensive methods where we're really looking at how do we diagnose and understand these problems and how do we try to really match up solutions. And a lot of that seems like it could really inform the practice of learning designers, because while learning is never almost never the full answer to a behavior challenge, it's almost always part of the answer. You know, there's almost always a learning component. And so how can we do that better? How can we, you know, structure and create learning experiences that are going to hopefully be more, you know, more ultimately effective or more, you know, more motivating for our audiences or any of those kinds of things. And so that's what led me ultimately to write the Elephant book, was because I felt like there's a lot here that we could be using in kind of, you know, training fields, you know, hopefully to both make our own training more effective, but also getting a little bit better at calling out when it's not fundamentally a training problem. And, you know, because whenever a big bad thing happens in an organization, they almost promise they'll do training, right? You know, something goes real wrong and like everybody shows up and promises we're going to do training. And it's always like, well, you know, is that really what the problem was? Sometimes, maybe, but is it the whole answer? Almost certainly not. So really understanding that and being able to kind of diagnose, you know, diagnose behavior change challenge as well.
Yeah, Julie, that's a great start. I had no idea that we'd start with condoms, but you know, it's a great kickoff. We got everybody hooked in.
Yeah.
And again, I think this is really a relevant topic because we're a large healthcare organization today. We've got hospitals across three states. We talk about training and we talk about learning all the time. And I'm really personally fascinated by it because I think that, and I think we'll get into this today, I think that we've often done training. And so people will say and acknowledge, yeah, I did that. Mm-hmm. But it's not showing up in their daily work, in their routines, in their habits. And so I want to go back to kind of maybe as a segue to your book, Talk to the Elephant. Tell our listeners a little bit about the book. You kind of said why, but tell us a little bit about kind of what you wrote about.
Yeah, well, I should probably explain the elephant thing.
Yeah. That'd be good.
Jonathan Haidt, who's a psychologist who actually has really moved on from this, he's now the guy who talks about why we shouldn't give kids cell phones, but, you know, or smartphones. But he has a metaphor in one of his earlier books called The Happiness Hypothesis, where he talks about our brains being like a rider and an elephant. And there's different versions of this metaphor. And, you know, things like Daniel Kahneman in the Thinking Fast and Slow kind of talks about these sort of dual, you know, thought process systems. And we know that this influences the choices that people make. So the elephant and the rider, if you think about, you know, your brain, like down by your spinal cord, you have like the areas of your brain that kind of manage a lot of the automatic functions of breathing and heart rate and reflexes. We've got things like vision and hearing and fine motor control and gross motor control and, you know, the limbic system, which has a lot of, you know, emotional regulation. So like a big portion of our brain real estate is concerned with our visceral reality and our, you know, how we feel, our feeling, thinking, you know, like our feeling, emotional, visceral selves. So it's, how do I move around? How do I move my body around in the world? How do I take, you know, how do I process what's coming in from my immediate environment? How do I understand it? How do I feel about it? All of these kinds of things. And then, you know, we have other areas of our brain that are like prefrontal cortex behind our eyes, which tends to activate when we're like using impulse control or executive function or planning for the future, you know, things like that. And he sort of describes that part of your brain as the rider and the other part of your brain as the elephant. And whenever we're making a decision, both systems kind of play into the decision making. So when your alarm goes off in the morning and it's kind of gray and it's a little dark because it's getting darker in the mornings and all of that kind of stuff, and your alarm goes up and you go, I should get up. I should totally get up. I should really get up so I have time to like get coffee and review my notes before I have to jump on that call or whatever. And you still hit the snooze button for 15 minutes. Like that's a classic kind of rider versus elephant decision. Your rider knows you should get up, but your elephant's like, no, it's comfortable and warm and nice and, you know, here. And your future self will deal with those other problems. And, you know, both entities have really important roles to play and are really, you know, crucial for decision making. And your elephant, you know, a big part of its job is to kind of keep you alive and, you know, keep you focused on certain things. But it's also got a very present bias. It cares about what's happening right now, not necessarily what's happening in the future. And so when we have these kind of systems fighting with each other, we have to make, you know, we're kind of constantly making decisions. And I think we're all smart, logical people. We're pretty sure we're going to be able to override our elephants. But the example I always like is, I don't know if you've ever seen these virtual reality setups where you can put on the VR goggles, and there's one, it's a game where you get in an elevator and you go up to the top of a skyscraper and the door opens and there's a little plank that like just goes out above the city street. And the question is, can you walk out on this plank? I did a version of this at the Stanford, the Virtual Human Interaction Laboratory, because they've used it for research purposes, where like the floor would open up and there's this little plank. And intellectually, I had all the knowledge in the world that this is still a carpeted, you know, meeting room. But my elephant was like, no, we are not walking across that little. Yeah. And I literally could not make myself walk forward unless I looked up at the ceiling. And then if I wasn't looking at the plank, I could tell myself that like it's a carpeted floor, it's fine. But if I was looking down, I couldn't do it. And so that's a case where my elephant was like, no, 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 no. And my rider could not. I think we like to give our riders more credit than we always deserve. I was working on, I'm kind of obsessed with hand washing in healthcare because I think it's such an interesting behavioral problem. And I was working on a curriculum a number of years ago on infection prevention control. And I was talking to one of the experts and she's like, even I struggle sometimes with a long day. Like I've worked an extra couple of hours. So I'm now at the end of a 12-hour shift and I know what I'm supposed to do. And she's, you know, she was one of the experts in that particular country on this topic. And she's like, even it's hard for me sometimes to, you know, adhere to what I know is the right thing to do because you're tired or you're hungry or you're, you know, you're just worn out or you're, you know, like, and all of this kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, these are the real challenges. And we're always negotiating this, whether we, you know, it's easy to say this is the right thing to do, but it's a lot harder to, you know, enact it as much as we all know we should.
Yeah. So the book Talk to the Elephant, I mean, I think you've again done a great job of kind of highlighting that. And I have heard it before, but I appreciate you kind of bringing that forward. And so how do we override that natural reaction or that, you know, real fundamental kind of pushback or stop? I mean, how do we talk to the elephant?
Well, you know, one of the things that we've historically done in a lot of training is just relied on talking to the rider. Like, I will give you the facts and I'll give you the argument and we'll make the logical statement. And then we're like, but yeah, that didn't seem to work. Right. We're still not seeing the behavior. And I think fundamentally, like, I've never seen a significant behavior change challenge that didn't have an element of kind of delayed or absent feedback. That seems to be one of the most common aspects of it. So if you think about the hand washing, like right now, my hands look pretty good. You know, if I look at my hand right now, it looks clean. But I also like picked up the dog a few minutes ago. And I know that, you know, and if from a healthcare point of view, my hands are absolutely not clean enough for healthcare. Like, but it's the rider that knows about things like germ theory, right? Like the elephant's like, I don't know, it looks okay. I think we might be all right, you know. Yeah. And it's this sort of lack of feedback at a bunch of layers. So like if I don't wash my, you know, if I'm a healthcare provider and I don't wash my hands at like 3 o'clock on a Thursday, well, the bad consequence is maybe a patient could get sick. But in most of our modern healthcare environments, the likelihood that I'll ever know that me not washing my hands at 3 o'clock on Thursday caused a particular patient to get sick, like that's basically impossible at this point. Like there's too many moving pieces to ever kind of draw that, you know, dotted line of I did this action and I had this consequence. And so we don't know about it until we've maybe got a patient on the ward who's sick, who's got, you know, an infection or something. So we're like, okay, we think we have a problem. And we really don't know about it until we look kind of at the system level and we're saying, well, our rate of infection is, you know, this compared to other kind of comparable organizations. And so when we have that disconnect between the behavior at the individual level, and, you know, the behavior happens at the individual level, but the feedback's not showing up until the system level. Well, those are really hard problems to solve because there isn't that mechanism, that feedback mechanism that's helping people kind of adjust their behavior in those sense of things. So when we look at that and we think about it from a training point of view, we have this disconnect between what my visceral environment is telling me, which is maybe my hands don't seem that bad, versus what my intellectual knowledge is telling me. And so then one of the questions that we would ask at that point is, how can I give you the experience of having the you know, actually having the experience of the consequences of this? And so if you look at any hand washing, you know, any reasonable hand washing curriculum, that's one of the things they try to do in that environment is make it feel real to people. So how do I make this? And so, you know, if you're in a well-resourced place, you use the black light, right? Or, you know, and there's a bunch of things. There's like rubber gloves where you rub stuff, you know, I've seen that version. You know, when I was working on this, I was working in West Africa on a curriculum through an NGO that I had done some work with, and they didn't have any of that kind of stuff. So they would do this thing where they would cough into their hand and then hold it out to shake and watch people's reactions as a way to make it feel real to people. Like, of course, there's reasons why you don't want to shake that person's hand. Now let's talk about that, you know, that kind of thing. There's a YouTube video I love where they paint a patient green and then watch all the places that the green paint goes in the clinic. So there's a number of different ways that we take something that's intellectual or conceptual and make it feel real. So we're not just talking to the rider. So the elephant's like, oh, yeah, that's bad, right? We want the elephant to kind of come along on that experience. And so when we're just talking about things in an intellectual way, as opposed to giving people some genuine experience of consequences or outcomes or, you know, the mechanism or something that makes it feel real for people, that seems to be the, you know, one of the tools in the toolkit is to is to make it feel real for people.
Yeah, I want to jump in there, Julie, because I like that example a lot. You gave several examples, and hand washing is a real one for us. We see it a lot. But I would still, I'm going to push back a little bit and just ask of, you know, if you let's say the green paint or the black light, those are still all kind of training, episodic training. And you talked about like the disconnect to behavior. So they do that training, they see it, they have an aha moment even, but then they go back and tomorrow that's not there.
Yeah.
And a week from now, that's not there. So how do you really rebuild a behavior, or what's that affirmation that once the training is over, once that episodic event is over, how do you really get sustainable change?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the sustainable is the challenging piece, right? You know, are we talking about a behavior that's used frequently or infrequently? Like the answer changes there a little bit. You know, if it's an infrequently used behavior, we're probably better leaning on, you know, environmental supports for it, because the likelihood that it's going to kind of stay sharp for people, you know, like it's just kind of not how brains work. You know, you can overlearn something, you know, and try to make it as automatic as possible. You know, we're always kind of dealing with this equation of how much effort do they have to expend to do the behavior, and how much motivation are they bringing to the table to expend that effort. And so one of the answers, and this is why, you know, I love organizations that are really taking that kind of improvement focus, because they will talk about, you know, like training tends to get siloed, and I'm going to change something about the person to make them react in their environment better, versus say like user experience design or fields like that, that are looking at how do we make the environment support the behavior better. And I do think that those two, I think we're along a continuum and we should be talking to each other more, because I mean, obviously a lot of the biggest gains in the hand washing stuff have been environmental, you know, the introduction of alcohol-based hand rubs and the way that we organize the different facilities to make hand washing, you know, like the process as you walk into the room and, you know, a lot of that kind of stuff. I mean, we almost never lose by making the behavior as easy to do as possible. But there's limitations to how easy we can make the behavior to do. And that's where kind of training and motivation, the training and motivation piece kind of come on the other side, which is how much force are we hoping the person exerts to get it done versus how easy are we making the behavior to do.
Jim, I want to kick it to you, see what you're thinking about.
What I really love listening to you talk, Julie, is, you know, I've heard a lot about the power of storytelling in getting messages across and in training and in learning and development. But you're taking this almost to another level of like it's storytelling, but it's to a very sort of specific part of our brain, that elephant, that emotional part of our brain, which I guess is, you know, where all storytelling has an impact, but to really affect that motivation. So is there a, you know, is it about the almost the severity of the story? Is it about, you know, we're trying to paint a picture in someone's brain of the consequences if you don't do this? I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, part of motivation is like, how important does this feel to you?
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the other challenges that always shows up is competing priorities, right? Like everybody's got like 37 different things that they need to do with every minute of every day. And it's not enough for us to come in at number 38 with a behavior. We need to come in the top five or it's just not going to happen. Right. And so what cues are people using to gauge, you know, the importance of something? And that's where the feeling piece actually becomes really interesting. There's research by Antonio Damasio, who does a lot of work in kind of neuroscience and emotion and things like that. And he looks at people who've had damage to the areas of the brain that process, you know, emotion. So they have very little, like they don't tend to get happy or sad or whatever. And the theory is that they're going to be really good decision makers. It's kind of the Mr. Spock brain, right? Like they're not, the messy emotions aren't going to interfere. Well, it turns out, no, they're terrible decision makers. Like, should I put on the blue shirt or the black shirt is like a stumper because they don't have any feeling about it. And I think our emotion and our feeling about something tells us it's important. We're fundamentally looking for, you know, looking for this to feel important. And so when we ignore the emotional cues or the story behind it, and that's where I think a lot of the storytelling is super important because it gives us that emotional context. So if I hear about insurance procedures, I'm going to be like, okay, this doesn't feel important to me. But if I hear about insurance procedures in the context of a family that's really, you know, dealing with a sick child, and this is all of the frustrations, and these are all the difficulties. All of a sudden, I'm like, oh, now this feels compelling to me, and now I care much, much more about insurance procedures because I'm seeing the human impact and I'm understanding, you know, kind of the emotions attached to it. And so we, and I think healthcare is definitely does this, where we try to like strip it down to the principles and the practices and our standard operating procedures and all of those kinds of things. And that's incredibly important, an incredibly important tool that we use to remove error from the system. But when we don't have any of those stories or any of those emotions or any of those kinds of things, we lose a lot of the context that kind of tells our elephants, like, no, this is really important. Yeah. We really need to care about it.
Yeah. It's actually a good segue. So in addition to your book, I mean, you've got a lot, and you got a workshop that you've also that I stumbled upon, but it's more about kind of sticky learning. So can you talk to our audience a little bit about that, and about, I think emotions is part of being sticky for learning objectives. Can you tell us a little bit about the workshop and about sticky learning?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things that we know, and the AI is going to make it worse, not better, is we've got an enormous amount of training content out there. And you know, one of the challenges is making it compelling enough for people that they are going to pay attention to it. I'll give you an example of an activity that I do. So on a scale of 0 to 10, what's your interest level right now? And 0 to 10 on a 5-minute video about printer repair. So Gemma, how about you? Where would you be?
Yeah, I'm going to say like 0, maybe.
Zero. Totally. Yeah. Good answer. How about Brad? What would you
do? Zero. I'm with Gemma.
0. Okay. Broken printer. You got to print your kid's permission slip for a thing, or, you know, a tax document. You have a thing you really have to get in the mail. And now what's your level of interest in the 5-minute video on fixing your printer?
10. Yeah.
10. Because I'm going to do it. Right?
Yeah.
A lot more interesting.
Okay. Okay, so now the third question, this is where it gets into training materials, is we're having a little workshop and I put a broken printer down in front of you and I say, hey, you're going to do a teamwork activity where you fix this printer. Now, what's your level of interest on the 0 to 10 scale in the 5-minute video on printer repair?
Probably not a 10,
but...
Well, I don't know. For me, okay. It would be because I'm a, you know, I want to perform and, you know, be the best in the room. So,
yeah, you're a good
5.
Team member. 5, okay. But here's the thing is, like, nothing about the video changed in any of those scenarios. What changed is, do we have immediate application for this?
I love that.
Right?
That's great.
Is there something I can do with it? And, you know, so we don't necessarily need to make our training materials really fabulous. You know, we don't need to add like dancing cats and unicorns to the training video, but we do need to give people something that they can do with it immediately. You know, some immediate purpose, some reason to pay attention to this. And then, you know, because there's this all this stuff about like people's attention spans shrinking. There's actually counter data to that. There's actually some data that suggests our attention spans are getting a little bit better in the same way that like IQs improve year over year and stuff like that. But what I think are changing are our habits of habits of attention or inattention, how quickly we're ready to switch on to something if we don't find it interesting. But if we've got a reason to pay attention. I mean, people still binge watch like 10 hours of Netflix. Like,
very
people
true.
Can pay attention for a really long time if they want to.
Yeah,
so how do we,
I think
do we
that's
create
a great,
that circumstance?
Yeah, I love the example of the printer repair video. I mean, that's great. And again, I think there's an application to healthcare. And it's we have a large healthcare audience. We have some folks that aren't in healthcare that are listening to Connecting the Dots as well. I think all this applies, but specifically in healthcare, I mean, creating emotional connection is a big part of why we do what we do. And a big part of our organizational kind of learning today is trying to create those meaningful and emotional connections to why this content is important. And I think hand washing, the example we talked about earlier, falls into that as well.
You know, the nurse practitioner that I was working with in that project at a certain point said to me, you know, 20 seconds doesn't sound that long, but sometimes it is. And she's like, and so I think to myself, I'm a good nurse. I can wash my hands for 20 seconds, which was the like clearest invocation of like identity and values to support a behavior I think I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. And that's part of it too. Like, how well do I connect up these behaviors to the things that I care about or the things that I think that I really value or important. And sometimes there is a connection, but people, you know, need help kind of, you know, again, seeing it and connecting the dots on it.
Connecting the dots. Good job, Julie. So we got a lot of, you know, managers out there, leaders of, you know, departments, you know, leaders of frontline workers today. And how would they, what's something practical that they can use? What would be a takeaway to our audience listening in today of how can they apply this even tomorrow at work? I mean, how should they be thinking about this a little bit differently when it comes to instructional design and how they're communicating with their teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of number one design principle that usually we're looking at is how is this actually solving an immediate problem for you, or how can I ensure that the learning, it feels like something I can use and apply immediately that's going to help me do things that I care about. And there's a lot of ways, you know, we will tend to create curriculum that starts out with the history of whatever topic, or, you know, all the background or whatever. And it's like, no, don't start with that. Start with, hey, here are three patients that you need to help. Let's talk about ways that you can do that, and then get into the material. So really that sort of ruthless focus on what can I do with this? How does this solve problems for me? It as a structure for, you know, most of the learning experiences. And then you aren't going to have nearly the, you know, the challenges of getting people to finish their training, or, you know, actually get, you know, mark stuff complete or whatever. If they feel like it's genuinely useful, they'll be there for it for the most part.
But you've really got to paint that picture of almost the consequences of, you know, what happens if you don't do this, or are you more focused on what will happen if you do them?
Right. And if you can have people bring their own problems to the table and look for solutions to them, that's going to be the most compelling. Like, that's the 10 out of 10 on the printer repair video, is when you actually have your own problem to solve. But even failing that, can you give people, you know, the feeling of being able to apply it immediately because we're structuring the training around common problems or something like that? Even if it's not the difficulty I'm having, I'll still engage if it feels like there's an interesting problem to solve.
Yeah, I'm just really thinking about, you know, whether it's a daily huddle or it's a kind of a PI project that's happening through daily management on the floor. I mean, there's lots of opportunities to intersect this thinking, designing for how people learn, really interacting at key points for leaders. The idea of talking to the elephant, and the rider, I think really good discussion for our teams. You know, there's a lot to continue to unpack there.
Yeah, and in a huddle, instead of, you know, one of the really like simplest tools that I sometimes talk about is just don't tell people why it's important, ask them why it's important.
Right.
You know, like pull it in from your audience. They will tell you, they know the answers to these things, you know, but then you get the social modeling of them saying it's important, and you also get them kind of putting their, you know, their money on the table too. They said it's important, so now that creates that kind of, you know, they want to act inconsistent with the things that they've said. And so that's going to create some motivation there too. So just flip that conversation around. Don't tell, ask, and then, you know, have them participate in figuring out what the solutions are, because we know that autonomy and, you know, feeling of agency in these environments is going to help as well. So there are actually a lot of tools in the toolbox. So just using them effectively.
Oh, that was another great connection to some other things that we've talked about. So Julie, how do people find out more about your work, and where can people get a copy of Talk to the Elephant?
Yeah, my website is usablelearning.com. And I also have a website, designbetterlearning.com, which is where people can find the course that I have on sticky learning. We're actually in the process of kind of bringing this all together into a, there was like no reason for these to be multiple websites, but those URLs will still stay good. And yeah, if they're interested in kind of the basics of learning design for how people learn is the book, and it's available on all of the outlets. And if people are really interested in the behavior change, Talk to the Elephant, Design Learning for Behavior Change. So yeah, those are all the places.
Fantastic, Julie. I had several questions I was going to jump in. The first one was I wanted to talk to you about how we view training, or at least a group of us do, as it's an experiment. You know, we think something's going to happen, and many times something different happens. But I decided not to go there because I thought, I think she already agrees with me on that one. But
I would love to have that conversation because I think the experimental mindset, is a really good one.
I would love to bring you back and just talk, Julie, more about training as an experiment. But here's the final question I'll ask you, because my friend Gemma here, I'll tell you, this is the one that drives me crazy. For 30-something years, I've seen people do workshops. I've seen them do keynotes. And they may have beautiful PowerPoints. They may even have great Oracle skills. I mean, just really good. And one of the common behaviors I've noticed is when the training is over, pretty much everyone in the workshop will look at that trainer and say, great job. Now, that's not what they say to each other, but they say that to the instructor. How do you know that this is stuck? That this has made a connection and you actually did deliver what you hoped that you would deliver?
Yeah. So this is going to get into book number three, which is the project this winter. But one of the things that we do is we tend to view training as an event and not as a process. And so like one of the fundamental questions I usually ask when we're starting out with something is like, all right, you want people to be good at clinical supervision, for example, right? Like, you know, managing and providing feedback to, you know, like people on their clinical staff or something along those lines. How long does it take somebody typically to get good at that? And people will tell me like, oh, a year or two or, you know, whatever. And I'm like, all right, well, what's the process? Because we tend to do like the 2-day workshop or the week long class or whatever. And then we just kind of push them out of the nest and hope that they fly.
Actually,
healthcare is better at this than a lot of other domains. I see this really frequently a lot in, you know, some other things where we actually have kind of more of a process for going back to the workplace and figuring out what's the feedback mechanism and how do they practice it and, you know, things like that. But really this sort of question of like, instead of the pushing out of the nest, what's the off ramp? How long does it need to be? And how do we plan for that? Because then you're collecting data sort of all along that, as opposed to, and that goes to what you were talking about, which is training as an experiment. You know, like how are we finding out what's working? Because did people like it is not an indicator, you know, or what people rated on their post-course evaluations, also not an indicator. You know, like they can tell you if you've got a big problem, like if everybody hated it, that probably means you got something you should look into, but it doesn't tell you if it works, you know. And right. So the, you know, if this is something that's going to take somebody a year typically to get good at, if the process of this is less than like 6 months, that's kind of a red flag for me, because it means we're not really thinking about like, how do we bring people along this path, and where are we collecting information and how are we judging, you know, the efficacy? And, you know, the specifics depend a little bit on what it is, and, you know, right. but the journey of, you know, really building a skill or really building an ability, you know, I think we, for reasons that are more logistical than, you know, practical or more, you know, we've got these short interventions that sort of drop in and then go away. And it, you know, it's not enough.
Yep. Right. Well, Julie, thank you so much for coming on Connecting the Dots. Whether you realize it or not, you already volunteered to come back a couple more times.
Sure.
So we're excited for future episodes, but in all seriousness, on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, thank you so much. We're so grateful for the work you do. So insightful. I was so impressed hearing you speak. I think it was on Michael Bungay Stainer's podcast, and just so grateful for everything you're doing and look forward to having you back again in the future. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I'd love to come back. You know, I'm always happy to kind of talk this through with people who really care about making things better. So that's a delight for me.